concept called Swing Easy. We all approach life, we all approach our careers, all our initiatives with this, you know, ardent passion and focus and trying really hard sometimes, and sometimes doing things that aren't natural to us as humans or as our persona. Swing Easy is a concept that if you watch a professional golfer, for instance, you see how smooth and easy they swing. Then you watch an amateur golfer and you see the differential. And swinging easy in your life is means being yourself, you know, staying true to your own personal values, and swinging easy at things, and you're amazing, involving other people. It's just a wide encompassing thing. And I got that advice a long time ago.
Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. I'm your host, Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simply Flying. Every Thursday, I have important conversations with top aviation executives, technology entrepreneurs, and policymakers helping aviation take climate action. Conversations that help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you are a frequent flyer or an airline executive, if you care about sustainability or simply love traveling, welcome aboard. Oscar Munoz is the former CEO of United Airlines. He led the airline through turbulent times, from major PR nightmares to turning around employee morale. And he shared a lot of these stories in his new book. He and I had a chance to speak and have a very frank conversation about the turnaround of United that he led, and also how he sowed the seeds of the sustainability strategy that United Airlines is following under the current CEO, Scott Kirby. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Oscar Munoz.
Oscar, great to be finally speaking with you. Congratulations on the new book, Without the Stress of Running the Airline Itself. I'm glad you have found the time and the space to write a book about your experience running and turning around United Airlines. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. And you as an author, a best-selling author, I may add, you understand that these endeavors bring along their own level of stress process. But it's been an interesting ride.
Having spent 15 years in aviation, I thought aviation was pretty broken. And then I tried publishing. And boy, that needs work.
maybe we should consult on that subject. Burgeoning, it's quite the process. So when I see you, I love your things behind you there. I like airport codes are something we do very well. So
absolutely, I've got airport codes everywhere surrounded by them. Oscar, when you took on the role, I remember that I think you were like 30, 40 days into your role as the new United CEO. And all of these headlines were about to go out, the first 100 days, the first 90 days. And then the unexpected happens. You had a medical emergency. You had a heart attack followed by a heart transplant just 30 plus days into your role as a United Airlines CEO. How did that medical emergency impact your outlook, firstly on life and then on leadership? I'm very curious.
Yeah. That's a long answer to that question. I'll try to be concise. I don't recommend it. It was 37 days exactly. And interestingly, it was 37 minutes from the time I called 911 to the time I was put on a medically induced coma. And it just goes on from there, all these interesting circumstances. I get that asked a lot about, gee, did it change who you were? I mean, it's a vital organ, clearly, but it's an organ, and yes, it's serious and it's daunting and it's scary as heck when you first get presented with that option. But as far as who I am and what I check with everyone all the time, it's still, I'm still the same person. It does add a little interesting to the sort of philosophical thing to your approach. It's you realize, like all of us should, that life and its cycle is indeed terminal. Just wasn't quite ready for it then, and so I'm just blessed beyond belief to know that I have this extra time and I have the great care of doctors. So my gratitude level certainly has gone up, and empathy for people in the same stage and awareness. But, you know, the things that I do on a regular basis and the way I lead, I think it was certainly a new tool that got added to the tool chest, because it created attention and awareness, and maybe some empathy here and there. Although I walked back into a proxy battle, union contracts, and there was no empathy there. So I don't think there was a high degree of all of that. But it really didn't change me at all, Shawshank. I think, you know, I'm still the same person that I've always been, but definitely much more grateful for every day I have in life. And which is a, you know, nice reminder for all of us to some degree.
Absolutely. And thank you for opening up. But are there similarities between recovering from a heart attack and recovering from business challenge, like, you know, the board battle you had going on and the turnaround that, you know, the United was starting under you?
You know, there's always parallels that I guess we could go to, but mostly it kind of puts things in maybe perspective. It's like, okay, yeah, this is awful. This is ridiculous. It's crazy. We're going through all that stuff. But I'm not in a hospital bed, you know, possibly dying. So that balance could give you a little, I think over the course for all of us as leaders, over the course of time, one of the things that experience teaches you, I guess, is the degree of being able to keep things in perspective. People call it calm, cool. I'm telling you, when you face big issues, the outward appearance of calm and cool is important to get everybody there, but the inner turmoil is difficult. I mean, these are difficult, you know, life-changing decisions for, in my position, you know, hundreds of thousands of people and employees and millions of customers. And so there's always that inner sort of engine that's running at full rev, but it did create a little perspective where it did calm you. It's like, oh, listen, this is serious, but there are more serious issues. And I think that allowed me to really, you know, really work with people on both sides of the equation to just put everything again back into a balanced view. You know, there's lots of emotion that runs in these things. I've learned to put that emotion aside, because emotion never really has solved anything. You know, it's just, we just get farther and further apart. And not to get off on too long a tangent, but in this country, we have an increasing level of divide that is not positive. And I will continue to do everything I can to begin to bridge those divides through healthy conversation, listening and learning from people, and so on and so forth.
Now, bridging divides is something is what you did. You bridged the divides between the employees, the unions, the board, and, you know, diversified the United board as well. You know, in your book, you've got a chapter from going from what's wrong to what's next. If you look back, what were some of two or three critical decisions you took that allowed United to go from focusing on what's wrong to what's next?
I think probably the most immediate decision was to, knowing that many things were broken, to determine a path to figure out what was the thing I needed to do first. I have coined a phrase that says, in turnarounds, probably the biggest advice you can give to someone is that because everything's broken, you need to go figure out what the right thing is. And you'll have lots of input, right? The street is not shortage, your customers have no shortage, your employees and outside consultants and your own inner team. But for me, the path to listen to the actual, in this business where we're a distributed workforce, you know, when you fly, you have an interaction maybe with a gate agent, certainly with a flight attendant. But other than that, that connection point is where things tend to go wrong for you as a flyer. So my decision to go after that and listen to them was probably the first and foremost. The second thing was actually to listen to the employees. And I have this concept of listening by being where they are, asking very simple questions and really, really getting at it. And then learning from that and then being able to lead. And then from those two sort of decisions to getting to the point where, you know, it's not quite a decision, but a philosophy that you got to provide something I call proof and not just promise. Because, you know, politicians go out and listen to the people and get all that stuff and say, we're going to do this or we're going to do that. In order to truly regain the trust of our employees, after so many different leaders had ostensibly, you know, sort of promised them the same thing, it was important for me to, whatever I took on, to let them know and to make sure that they all knew that, you know, that we delivered. And I think one of the one of the remaining things that I feel good about is two things. When you talk to a United employee that was there during my tenure, you ask them about Oscar, which is how known, you're going to get a smile, almost guaranteed. And if you ask anybody, and I've said this out in public all the time, it's like, did he ever promise something that he didn't deliver? Or did he ever say something he was going to do and he never did it or forgot about it? And those are more human traits than just leadership traits, but we should always remember them as leaders, that it's important to do that. Because, you know, the place was broken. I call it disenfranchised, disengaged. You know, the employees were just not any place. So those decisions, you know, really seeking a path to go learn from them was probably the most critical of all.
You mentioned questions. So one of my really good friends is a senior captain with United. He's flown with United for 40 years. And yes, every time he and I spoke about you when you were the CEO and after you had left, he did smile. So I actually agree with that. I want to dig a little deeper here. What was that question you asked the United employee when you said, I would ask simple questions? What did you ask them?
It was a variant of some, you know, deeply researched, academically supported questions. No, I just walked up to you and said, Shawshank, how you doing? It's like, how, there's always something when you genuinely reach out to a human being and you want to engage, especially when you're the quote CEO of a company and they've maybe not have ever seen many of them. They're at a much different level of things. And so they can get worried. So how you reduce the tension and friction as you engage with someone? So there's always something about someone when you first see them that you can notice, right? You know, you're wearing a vest that has a tennis, like you've got the thing in the background from airport. So you immediately try to find not necessarily a connection, but it's like you just warmly ask, hi, how's it going? I noticed you have a lanyard that says, you know, the Raptors or something, but you try to figure out something. And then generally a lot of people, especially ones that have been around for a long time and have really become disengaged, they're like, who the heck are you? Why are you bothering me? Get out of my face. And that's, by the way, an understatement of some of the sentiments I received when I went around doing this, because people were angry. And you allow people to, you know, to first try to mollify their passion and the tension that's created by more simple human things. So it wasn't a profound question or survey. How are you doing? What can we do to help? I understand. Tell me what that is. And then people would respond with questions or with thoughts like, well, you know, screw you. We've heard all this crap before. I'm cleaning up the language for your podcast. And then I would just gently but sternly answer. It's like, so that's right. The CEO of the company has been here in front of you, three or four people or 400 or 500 people, whatever, in the middle of the night in a hangar or in a break room. You know, it's like, so the CEO has been here before and asked you this question. And the answer was no. It's like, no, it just wasn't something that had been done, which is why we had become so disenfranchised and disengaged. And so that helped a lot. So this question was not a real difficult one, but it was hopefully a ice-breaking, trust-building, tell me everything. And so tell me they did. And so the question wasn't the key, it was the human sort of inactivity that really promoted that, probably.
Right. I think it was really the connection from a leader coming down to, let's say, a ramp agent and, you know, having a one-to-one conversation at the same level. It seems like you heard everything, you know, from abuse to disenchantment. What was it that you heard that encouraged you to carry on? Why didn't you just go back into your shell and do your weekly meeting with the top leadership and the head of customer experience, tell me what's wrong, and the head of crew, tell me how can I improve? What did you learn from these conversations that got you to continue?
So two things. One, I heard a variety of things. I would say 90% of them were not positive, but I would see things and spot things and say, wow, you know, a flight attendant who was really upset about a lot of different things. But you know what? I watched her work that plane and I watched her work the customers. And so despite her obvious level of emotion and passion about things that weren't right with the company, her personal desire to take care of you as a customer, that was something that was right. So observation is part of listening, right? So you're hearing all these things. So I heard a variety of things. The difficult of the listening is that it's hard to categorize all of those things and then eventually evolve them and have them converge onto, all right, big guy, you got all these answers. What the hell are you going to do with it? And I remember a specific story that after being out on the road for a few days or for a few weeks and heading back to Chicago and thinking this very same thought, the question is just asked like, oh, you've got lots of information. You got lots of data. Which one is the one that you're going to pick from? And I did not have that answer. So to your question, what kept me going, despite the negativity, is that I still hadn't quite figured it out yet. And it's one of these magic kismet karma things. I'm heading back to Denver shortly before I had my heart attack. And I walked up to the front galley and met with, it was a flight attendant up there, doing her work. And I walked up there and asked the question. It's like, hi, I'm Oscar, how's it going? And by this time it was pretty much out in the workplace that Oscar's walking around and he seems to be talking to us. He seems to be listening. He's not a total jerk, whatever phrases and use that we're doing. So we were growing, people were opening them up. I could see people opening up a little bit more, but not everyone. And this particular flight attendant, Amy Sue is her name. I could tell the emotion in her face, almost anger at being bothered by someone while she's working. We don't have enough time to talk about all this crap. You could just feel that emotion. And I just gently, I remember touching her gently on the arm as she was working, just as I was like, listen, I understand you're busy, but I would really love to hear. And then her answer was really the platform, if you will, the infrastructure, the watershed moment, and all those other concepts of what we were able to do with United. Because she stopped, she looked at me, she broke into tears, and she said, Oscar, I'm just tired of always having to say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry the coffee sucks. I'm sorry we don't have food. I'm sorry you can't do that. I'm sorry we're late, right? And as I thought through her answers, it's like, wow, it's like, that's what it is. We have put tens of thousands of frontline employees in a situation where they're constantly having to apologize for things they have zero control over. I have to come every day, know it's going to be late, know they're going to be pissed, and I have to go into that. And over time, I don't care who you are, you do get tired of that, and you do grow in this disengaged, disenfranchised sort of a combination. And so for me, it was really crystallizing, because when I went back to my seat and I said, oh man, I think I got it. Now the next chapter was, okay, so I have it, but I have an entire management team. I have a huge corporation. And how is this going to manifest itself? And at the end of the day, to make a long story shorter, X amount of time later, after I'd come back from my health vacation, we went through this concept of using, regaining the trust of our employees was going to be mission one. And from that, everything else would follow.
That is a deeply moving story. And, it speaks volumes of why this worked, why you prioritized employees. So gaining the trust of employees definitely seems to have come before gaining the trust of customers, or were they going in parallel? Did you intentionally sequence that? Let me work the employees first, who will then work the customers. Was that the goal?
100%. In fact, just from a chronology perspective, this culminating moment came to me. I had a few more visits to do, but I was really beginning to crystallize. I felt much more confident. Everything I heard, I would actually repeat that story to a lot of folks when I'd have employees. It's like, hey, you know what? I heard this. And they would all, you could see the head nodding. It's like, that's it. That's it. So I was feeling really good about it. Unfortunately, I had this heart event. But fast forward to, I've had the heart event. We're having a strategy retreat, even though I am due for a transplant, but no one knows whatsoever except myself and my family. But we have this strategy retreat because it's like, I wanted to get this moving. I didn't know when a transplant was going to come. I had this device that kind of kept me alive attached to me. But we were having a great conversation. And in a weird, again, juxtaposition of events and kismet and karma and all those things, on the morning, so we had a full blown out session, to your question about, how do we do this? What should we do? There's customers, there's our systems, there's our financial situation, there's aircraft, there's just a thousand things that need to be fixed. And I'm letting the senior Millis management teams kind of work through all of this, kind of in my own heart, knowing where the direction is going to head, but I can't force that upon them. So we're working through that. We make a lot of progress. By the end of one of the days at our meeting, things are beginning to sort of evolve to this. You know what the problem is? It isn't all this other stuff. Is our people. We've lost our people. And so the next day, we're going to make the final decision as to what our big new thrust is going to be. And it is the morning that I get my call from the doctors that say, we've got a heart for you. And if you could come in later in the afternoon, we'll begin the process for doing the transplant surgery. I didn't have to go to the afternoon. So I said, well, can I go into work? And I'm like, whatever you want to do, go into the office, carry on the meeting, have a full-blown morning where we come to this culminating point that regaining the trust of employees is going to be our first big initiative, and that there's going to be rancor and noise and craziness because customers are going to get upset to your question. Investors are going to go, what the hell does that mean? Right? That's clearly an expensive proposition and you don't have that money to spend and so on. And that doesn't really feel like a really intellectual strategy. That sounds like touchy. You're going to have all that sort of stuff. But we've all culminated and voted and said, that's the thing. We literally break for lunch. And before we sit down for lunch, I said, hey guys, there's something I got to do at the hospital. And then I say the infamous words that I will see you on the other side. And then realizing, oh crap, that could mean a lot of different things. And then I went without anybody knowing at the time to the hospital to go get prepped for my surgery, which would replace my heart for the next day. And on top of all of that, that day was my birthday. I'm telling you, you cannot make this stuff up. It's
as long as it wasn't your 37th birthday. on that day.
We
have to test this because from a United Airlines brand and customer perspective, this was a watershed moment, I feel. And that's the Dr. Dao incident. You have shared until now how you prioritize employees, and that's all well and fine. But it seems, you know, you're just getting rolling and then this customer incident happens. We all know what happened. I was in the boat as a customer where I told my staff here at Simply Flying, we will not fly United until United takes care of this. And we've now started flying United again a few years on. But the question is, that was a tough one. You, in your first initial tweet that was leaked, I think, or email, you sided with the employees and you said, you know, I'm with you and let's do this together. But very quickly, you had to, because how it was blowing up in the media, you had to come and make a public statement. What would you have done differently in that incident?
In hindsight, a couple of things. Probably, let me attack that from a lessons learned. Because those are the things. And by the way, it's become a fairly infamous, well, the important sort of business case that all the big schools talk about. I've seen the evolution of those cases to go from kind of where you started, no, we're never going to do that again, to, here's some things. And I get quite a few calls from the senior most leaders of corporations here and abroad. Quietly saying, so I've got this crisis. Let me run you what to know. So first and foremost, we were arguably, and we've tried to research this, so I can't say this empirically, we may be the first large corporation's brand to be sort of to hit this social media sort of concept. This was 2017, which doesn't seem a long time ago, but Twitter was, of course, here, but I know in corporations it wasn't something we didn't have a social media team that was monitoring these things. It was just normal corp com and crisis management people around. So I and we did not necessarily understand the power of that. So the initial response to something on Twitter was to try and correct and you'll know this, and your audience will know this concept of that first somebody else had a response. Somebody on the team said, you know, we're sorry for it was an overbooking situation. Overbooking is a loaded term with regards to there's regulatory issues and all that sort of thing. And I think your audience understands why things are overbooked, because not everybody shows up for the aircraft and we run on thin margins. So we want to make sure we fill the seats. So the initial sort of conversation was around we have to get rid of that word. And so that word became, we're apologized for reaccommodating, which in hindsight, yeah, accommodate stupid. The lesson there, what I tell everybody is like what I would have done is I would have ran the video of that incident in front of my senior most management team and all the people that are involved. And people don't like it when I say it this emphatically, but we should have watched it till we got sick to our stomachs. And I think that would have instructed us to understand, you know, I'm Mr. Listener. I didn't, you know, I should have put myself in the folks like you when you see this. It's like, oh my God, this is awful. And I think our initial response would have been different. But the second lesson is that it's never too late to do the right thing. And so we get that. We have an awful day of bad conversation. The fact that it wasn't United Airlines, it was an express carrier. It wasn't United Airlines employee that it was the Chicago Police Authority, right? Not the only United employee per se was a supervisor, a gate supervisor that was sitting there watching the thing, just like, you know, you and many other folks saw it. And so, and the customer himself wasn't a, you know, an upstanding citizen in a lot of ways. And so the combination of all of those quote facts, and I'll point it out to, hey, wait, you know, it's not entirely right. The initial decision to try and cast blame. And so that's the second lesson, is that we should have, we really should have, you know, won. And then the third lesson is to, okay, go own it. So I went live on Good Morning America a couple, you know, a day later. And rather than begin to, you know, I think part of the packaging was that, hey, how do we let people know, not American, police isn't us, all that sort of stuff. It's like, no one's going to care. In my mind, for a lot of different things that I cover in the book and otherwise, it's just not the right thing to do. So I just went on camera and said, you know what? My fault. We let policies and procedures, which was get in the way of doing the right thing for a human being. And that should never happen. And of all the things, the ultimate lesson was to own it and take it and take all the heat and associated with it. By the way, not just from external people, but internal people. It's like, wait a second, what the heck? Why are you saying we are at fault? We weren't, you know, because the people were emphatic that we were not at fault. It's like, no one's listening. And so took it, ran it, put things out there. Hey, in 30 days, we're going to do these various things. And the news cycle hits you, you go through it. And then, and more importantly for me, my answer was going to be that one I could answer years into the future. I didn't want to have this created, crafted, you know, PR spin thing that had to be done so well, because that just wasn't the truth from my perspective. So I just said, you know what? Me, it's all my fault. And here's how we're going to fix it.
Yeah. And I think, thanks for being open and upfront about this. It's hard to talk about it. It was not a proud moment, I think, at that time. But it's important to take these lessons learned. And just like you shared, you know, going and approaching the employees and asking, how are you doing? Genuinely expecting a real answer. It shows empathy. And then showing empathy to the customers just becomes so important.
By the way, it was also a catalyst. If you think of the customer service evolution in the airline industry, and you travel the world and you see a lot of the international airlines, which are deemed to have really good, you know, service, and of course they do. It's just a very different business model for those international companies versus us here in the United States. But it created a little bit of a revolution with regards, because we certainly had the religion to get this done. And so NPS became an issue. So now what you hear from a lot of domestic airlines is a big, strong emphasis and focus on that. So no, not the best way of doing it, certainly, but it certainly kickstarted the movement initiative to be much more customer centric.
You're right. Absolutely. I'm glad to hear, you know, there were some positive lessons taken out of this. And one of your master strokes in hindsight has been the appointment of Scott Kirby as the current CEO of United. You know, run me through. I grew up in Singapore, and I'm well aware of how Lee Kuan Yew groomed his successor, the next Singapore Prime Minister. Was this something planned? Is succession planning part of what you think defines you as a leader? And I would love to, you know, get the backstory of Scott's appointment as the CEO.
Yeah. So two things. One, United had a really poor history of succession planning for a lot of different issues. Bankruptcies, mergers, and so And the best proof point for that is like, how the hell does a guy on the board who runs an airline, a railroad, all of a sudden, you know, in a couple months, become the CEO? So that's not the right succession plan. And so, and again, any CEO will tell you what is your one top two or three responsibilities. And I think from a true leadership perspective is beginning to develop that succession plan early on, so that the board has options, and importantly, that there's continuity. And I think that for me, that was the critical thing. So there's a whole journey about how Scott and I came together. I touch on it gently in the book, because that's really, I think, Scott's story to tell at some point in time. But he and I spent a lot of time together. He had a lot of history. Everybody knew him in the industry. I don't think anybody has any issues with his intellect and his experience and strategic ability in this space. It was more on the leadership and can he actually run. And so we spent, you know, 3 to 4 years really working on some of those things together. And so the succession planning process began, honestly, as soon as I hired him, right? Because you hire someone of that capability as your president, there's really no confusion about who is at least scheduled to be. It's just a matter of time when we do it. And so that was the process. And it's difficult for a senior most leader to start that, especially with someone that has that kind of capability. But, you know, Scott and I and our recent, we really worked well together. And he really, I think, came to understand that you know, for lack of a better, that EQ side of being a senior leader. And for me, it was kind of simple, because I had been, you know, the number two person in my previous company, and then slated to be the number one shortly after I announced I was leaving for United. And so there are two different jobs. They require such different capabilities. And so, the hallmark of great companies is how they do this well. You just talked about something in your own country, and because it's relatively seamless. Scott is his own person, has his own demands, but the underlying foundation of, you know, our tagline thing, good leads the way, and the new spirit of United, and connecting people and uniting the world, all of that nomenclature, all of that concept is still out there and still working.
I'm glad to hear that. Now, I actually had Scott Kirby on this podcast previously, and I've interviewed him myself. He is extremely passionate about sustainability. And that stood out. I spoke with him about a variety of issues, including during COVID and the recovery. The moment he gets talking about sustainability, he's all charged up and he's speaking completely off the script. And I'm curious, if you look towards the future of aviation, how important is sustainability and airline industry is so hard to decarbonize? How do you think aviation can become greener? And do you think United is on the right path?
I'll start with the premise that I started when I was there, because we were the first U.S. airline to actually, say something about this before it was cool. You know, 2018, I believe, is when we made our first pledge. And, the question that I pose to you and to everyone that listens to you with regards to this concept of sustainability, because everybody uses the word, throws it around. I mean, do you believe that there's something going on in our planet regarding climate change? And, you know, there's still a lot of people that don't believe it and still people that do. I have lost my patience with trying to convince people that say, no, everything's fine, because you're never going to get past those folks. It's almost a political view or something that they're not going to do. So, but if indeed you think there's something that you look at the facts and you say, yeah, you know, maybe something's not quite right. It's like, you know, can you do something about it is the second question. And of course, there's always things we can do, right? We can do everything at home and your businesses. The real question is, will you do something about it? And I think from day one, the question that I posed to ourselves and our team was, you know, will you do? And so we began sustainable aviation fuel investments, R&D, convincing somewhat strong-handedly sometimes all the other CEOs and airlines in the world to join us. There were numbers like we were almost 70% of the future contracts on the available sustainable aviation fuel in the world. And now it was a small number, so saying 70% was not a big deal, but that headline caught people's attention. It was like, well, how the hell is United ahead of us in that regard? And so we created quite the sort of momentum. You saw some of the flight shaming issues beginning at the northern parts of Europe. And so we, you know, without scaring people, it was like, it's coming. We should do, can you do something? Yes. Will you do? What does that take? And that's what you've seen. And that's what you've seen Scott really take and run with it. But in the phase of convincing people in the industry to do something, it wasn't about green specifically and sustainable and the whole political tree hugging kind of people that didn't view it. It became, and again, you know this industry well, it's like, what is the most volatile line item on our P&L? Fuel. How do our equities trade on the volatility of fuel, right? I mean, everybody knows that. So what if we could develop a sustainable methodology of fuel purchasing that was not volatile, right? And if we can do that, think of what would happen to our equities. And that business angle conversation, I think, resonated infinitely more, and it's led to those things. And to your point, Scott has taken it. He's very, very, very engaged in a very deep level about this and has taken it and really run with it.
Really glad to see the early momentum that is being carried forward now. You are also on the board of Archer. I also had Archer's CEO on this podcast previously, and he's rethinking eVTOLs and urban air mobility in a way very few others are. Why are you on the board, and what is it that you believe about this model that will change the way we view aviation?
A couple of things. First, I watched the Jetsons when I was a kid, and I'm always wondering if that was ever going to happen. Even as a kid, I was like, how did they not run into each other and all that sort of thing? So it's a cool concept. But really, I think there's a few things that drive at least my engagement and involvement. First one, and I've written and talked about this a lot, the technology and the way we fly in this planet hasn't really evolved over time. We've gotten more fuel efficient for sure. My engines are better. We've got streamlined range issues with aircraft and all the things that you know about. But there hasn't really been anything revolutionary happening. We got better seats. We got, video on demand and Wi-Fi, those sorts of things. But really, there hasn't been much in the way of that. If you think about what an eVTOL does, and then at the same time, a company like Boom in the supersonic space, which kind of fell off after Concorde, those are two things that I'm engaged with today. And Archer was a specific area of I felt it was not only a good investment. I joined the board to help them get past a lot of the things that we're going to have to get past of. But at the same time, this ability to understand, again, from my perspective, the customer, right? I we live in Chicago. I live 19 miles from the airport. It could take me 40 minutes. It could take me 3 hours. And again, back to this concept of volatility of my own stress, comfort level, hope that you get, it's like, we can fly from downtown Chicago to, we will be able to fly from downtown Chicago to O'Hare in under 10 minutes, 7 or 8 minutes, And so, again, 40 minutes to 3 hours versus a guaranteed 7 minutes. So the usability of this thing, the sustainable nature of it, the very cool development of the technology and the capability is always a nice journey. And then, keeping the customer in mind, the cost of it is not going to be what the helicopter businesses, Blades and all those charge. That's a kind of a high-end product. This will be around the cost of a black Uber car ride to the airport. So it's not pricing the entire market. And beyond just getting back and forth as an air taxi, to the airport for the airline, which is one of the reasons we were looking at it. It also has the potential to really broadening, and I'm sure Adam, who has great vision as a founder of this, has a great view of it. It's going to really open up the world for a lot of different people. And so it's a revolutionary product. The friction points that you're going to have with existing regulation and current infrastructure is going to be something that we are really beginning, because we have that vehicle in the air and transition flying. And so now we've been very focused on working along with FAA all along the way. Not let's build it and then throw it over to them to apply. It's like, listen, why don't you kind of keep us in mind? We are building this thing, back to my decision to join that versus the other ones that are out there. It is built and designed for commercial use soon. Right now we're kind of in the next year or so is what we're thinking. That's for the company to make those announcements. But at the same time, FAA is going to be a critical partner in this, and they've been alongside us all the way.
I'm glad to see. I've been following Billy Nolen's updates as well, and I know he's pretty excited personally about this. I do hope to get on an Archer Midnight, perhaps for the Los Angeles Olympics in a couple of years from LAX after getting off a United flight onto Long Beach to catch a volleyball event. Perhaps I think that would be
amazing. No. Listen, making it a viable product that's safe above all. And it'll deliver what we say it is. And, technology and batteries is developing at light speed. So we have the best and brightest. That'll just continue to get even better and better. And again, one of the natures is to make this available, not just to the few rich and poor, but certainly to a broader audience.
Absolutely. Final question. To be a sustainable business, aviation needs to get sustainability right. What do you see as the sustainable business of aviation in the future?
You're talking not necessarily green, but the business aspect. I tell you, you got to remain relevant, and you got to connect people to the things that matter most in a way that suits them, and that is the customer centricity. We lost our employees for a long time at United, and some of my parting thoughts to Scott and the management team and to the board is like, we can never let them get disenfranchised and disengaged again, because I don't know that they come back for a second or third time. I think we lose them. And so to have a sustainable business, you got to have this foundation of humans that takes care of other humans. And then you do what Scott loves to do and his team is like fly a lot of places and, make people, right? Because that's what we want to do. And we want to do it. We want to have access to the rest of the world and use that great, great United network that's always been in place. We've just never found the right people to solve that puzzle. Well, with these kind of transitions that we've made since, I think we're ready to go.
Right. Before the interview, I was thinking through the questions, having followed you for over a decade now. I was thinking, probably Oscar's biggest legacy after United was ensuring that Scott Kirby is there. But I feel that your legacy, listening to you now for the last hour, is also ensuring that empathy is a fabric as part of the business across the leadership, across the employees. And then, of course, that translates through the customers. Your next book should be Scaling Empathy, perhaps.
Well, again, I'll tell you, I think one of the objectives of the book is to show proof, not promise, that a style of treating people the right way, listening to them, and putting those things into action and putting the right team around it is also very successful. There's just not one way. And importantly, I hope to prove, and it's proving now, that it's durable, because people can come in and do things, but then that person leaves and things fall apart. The durability that we have is that spirit of people in United that's important. And so it's great. But it's been great talking to you. I appreciate the conversation.
I do have one final round, Oscar. I have one line questions where everyone gets to learn a bit more about you. And you have to tell me the first thing that comes to your mind. So we'll start with something simple. What's your favorite airline?
Come on. Really? The friendly skies, baby.
All right, we'll skip that one. Very, very simple. What's your favorite book?
Oh, gosh. Book on Lincoln, Team of Rivals. Mm-hmm. That was not that I'd ever fancy myself like him, but that bridging divides is a really big thing. So I know it's more than a few words.
Absolutely. Doris is a fantastic writer. I have that on my bookshelf as well. What's your favorite city?
Yeah, I'm not going to go there either. It's like it's like seeing your favorite child. I mean, that's like, how would I do that? It's like, no. So many wonderful places in the world, and United flies to all of them.
Okay, how about this? What's your favorite vacation spot? Is that better?
Yeah, as you travel around the world, any place there's water and surf and good food, Italy always hits that mark to some degree.
Okay, all right, I'll take that. What's your favorite movie?
Oh, gosh. The Godfather. The books were amazing. And one of the few books where the movie actually had some resemblability.
That's very nice. What is something you want to learn?
how to throttle down when you're in retirement, maybe.
Here you are doing a book launch. So I think that's...
We have so many things. We have, you know, I'm doing a lot of things for my heritage, I think. You know, we started a venture fund and all the boards that I do, but it's really meaningful to give back. And so I'll always continue to get a lot of energy from that.
Sure. What is something you like to do in your free time, Oscar?
Oh, gosh. So again, I'm a big water person. Surfing is great. I mean, I golf. I do a lot of different things, but there's something about being in the water. There's just you, yourself, and nature that, you know, like Scott likes to hike and all that stuff. We all have our little version. There's solace in just you and your physical abilities. It's a really important thing to sort of, you know, get a lot of things out of your system.
Do you surf very regularly, every day or something?
Oh, no, gosh, not every day, only because I'm traveling every day. I would if I could, and I would if there's waves. So no surfer surfs every day because you need something to surf on.
What's your favorite surf spot?
So many different places. I think traveling abroad to places like Costa Rica and places in Tahiti, certainly Hawaii has a lot of great spots. But there's just local spots that I grew up in California. There's a place called the River Jetties between Newport Beach and Huntington Beach. You still know people there. Surfing has gotten a little, what the term is, aggro, a little aggressive. If you're not a local, it gets a little harder. So it's always important. I still have a lot of family in the area, so I make sure that I go out with my nephews so they can vouch for me. Who's the old guy?
Final question. What is the best advice you've ever received?
Oh, gosh. And it was a longer story, but I've turned it a concept called swing easy. We all approach life, we all approach our careers, all our initiatives with this, you know, ardent passion and focus and trying really hard sometimes, and sometimes doing things that aren't natural to us as humans or as our persona. Swing easy is a concept that if you watch a professional golfer, for instance, you see how smooth and easy they swing. Then you watch an amateur golfer and you see the differential. And swinging easy in your life means being yourself, you know, staying true to your own personal values, and swinging easy at things, and you're amazing, involving other people. It's just a wide encompassing thing. And I got that advice a long time ago when I thought I was all that, right? I was young and smart. I had all these great jobs initially. I just thought I was, you know, better than everyone. But when I slowed down and learned to swing easy and let others in, the trajectory of my career even went further. And it led me to conversations like we've had over the last hour about how I approach leadership.
Fantastic. Oscar, thank you so much for opening up, for not shying away from any question. I do wish you all the best for the book. I can't wait to pour through it on my next flight. And thanks once again.
Thank you, Shashank. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air. Aviation is one of the hardest to decarbonize industries, yet there are multiple paths to get to net zero. Awareness is key to a green future. So please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing this episode on your network, on LinkedIn, Twitter, or even WhatsApp. Or perhaps you might consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this episode. You can start a conversation with us by writing to us at podcast@simplifying.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website green.simplifying.com and join the movement. Sustainability in the Air is an original podcast by Simplifying. The show is produced by Juraj Toth in Slovakia. Dirk Singer is our Director of Sustainability, who leads research for each interviewee out of Greenwich, UK. Shubhadeep Pal is our supervising editor based out of Mumbai and Singapore. The articles are written by Ayushi Badola in Dehradun in India and Meera Hull in Montreal, Quebec. Creative design is led by Ligia Esteve in Montreal. Baiba Dreamen is the project director for the show based out of Valencia, Spain. Special thanks to Wendy Sim in Singapore. And I'm Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simplifying and your host. Please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.